Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the FSI Second Quarter Advisor Briefing. My name is Shelley Lee, and I'm your moderator today. I work with FSI on marketing and communications to support their advocacy strategy. This is the second advisor briefing call. FSI began this series of calls in January of this year as a way to keep you updated on all the issues that affect your business and to let you know of the advocacy efforts being undertaken on those issues on your behalf. Joining me on the call today is Dave Belair. Dave is FSI's General Counsel and Director of Government Affairs. And we hope also to be joined by Dale Brown. Dale is the President and CEO of FSI. He is, as we speak, wrapping up a meeting with officials from the Treasury Department in Washington on an important issue you'll want to hear about. And so he's going to call in as soon as he can and give us an update on that issue and other activities he's got underway in Washington. Before we get started, I also want to mention the member surveys that FSI is doing. Dave's going to talk about the results from the first one, and a second member survey is going to be sent out in a week or two, and we would appreciate your taking the time to fill that out. They're very short, but it helps us know what issues are on your minds and how we can continue to add value to these calls and to other advocacy activities and communications. We have some questions from some of you that have been emailed in advance, and we're going to get to those at the end of the call. And also, while we're on the call, if you have a question and you want to send an email real quickly, you just need to email that to advisorbriefing@financialservices.org, and we'll try to get to those at the end. So we're ready to get going. Dave, you're up. So let me turn to you. Now that health care reform has passed, would you give us an update on the other big issue in Washington, and that is regulatory reform, financial services reform underway? And maybe give us a little perspective on how we got to the point where we are right now and what the latest proposed legislation, which is RAFSA for short, if I'm not mistaken, what that means or could mean for advisors' businesses, and then maybe some expectations on outcome and timeline.
Sure. First of all, just a kind of an update on where we stand from two perspectives, procedurally and then substantively. Procedurally, the House passed its version of regulatory reform late last year. And since that time, they've been waiting on the Senate to take up legislation. Last month, the Senate Banking Committee approved on a party line vote their version of the bill, and are now preparing to proceed on the Senate floor to vote on the bill. But Republicans at this point are denying them the 60 votes that they need to bring their bill to the floor. And that is based upon concerns that the Republicans have about a number of issues in the bill that are really kind of unrelated to the Financial Services Institute's agenda and the issues that most directly impact independent financial advisors and their broker-dealers. More substantively, the Senate bill, which is more likely to reflect what the final legislation would look like, directs the SEC to conduct a study of all of the issues that are relevant to the harmonization of broker-dealer and investment advisor regulation, something that the Obama administration indicated was a key initiative in the retail investment advice and financial services area. And the Financial Services Institute supports that study because we think it'll provide all the interested parties an opportunity to provide input into the development of an effective investor protection solution without the unintended consequences that might result if we hurry that and make mistakes in its implementation. So this issue of harmonization of broker-dealer and investment advisor regulation is important because it really has the potential to have very significant implications for financial advisors. This is the whole debate around whether financial advisors should be held to a fiduciary standard or suitability standard or some new standard. And as a result, it really could have an impact on so many areas of our members' business. Everything from the disclosures that you have to provide clients, to how you're paid for your services, the products you sell, and even the clients that you can afford to work with. So I'm challenged to think of any issue that's more of a foundational principle than the standard of care people owe their clients. And so I think it's important that the Senate bill move forward in its current state, allowing a detailed study by the SEC of these issues before adopting regulations to implement the findings of the study.
Dave, let me ask you, if for those who may have been keeping up with what had happened in the fall with the House's bill, can you give us an overview of the major differences in what the House passed and the Senate bill that is going to be taken up?
Sure. The main difference is that the House bill identifies a standard, new standard of care that should be applied to broker-dealer and investment advisor relationships with clients. And it creates a new fiduciary duty that has some language in it that is troublesome, in that it would require financial advisors to offer advice in the best interest of their clients without regard to their own personal financial or other interests. Now, I think most financial advisors, especially those interested in being in the business for a long time, do in fact offer advice that is in the best interest of their clients. But I think they'd be hard pressed to say they do so without regard to their own personal financial interest. After all, very few financial advisors are out offering their services for free. So that language has been troublesome for us and other trade organizations. And so we are quite pleased that the Senate didn't take that approach. Instead, they have adopted a detailed study, as I mentioned earlier, of these issues. And so we're supportive of that effort and hopeful that the final legislation will include a robust study of these issues with plans to move forward with regulation to carry out the findings of the study.
Dave, on this subject then, two kind of follow-up questions. What do you expect as far as the timeline? I think that the Senate bill may come to the floor this week. Is that correct?
That's right. The big issue now is that Senate Democrats need 60 votes to move forward and bring the bill to the floor for debate, and they're one vote short. The Republicans have all signed on to a letter, all 41 Republicans have signed on to a letter stating that they are not ready to move forward and allow debate to occur because they have concerns with the existing legislation. And so Democrats are attempting to exert influence and pressure on the Republicans to fracture their coalition and get the necessary votes to move forward. At the same time, there are behind-the-scenes negotiations going on trying to bridge the gap between Democrats and Republicans on the key provisions of the bill. So at this point, there doesn't seem to be a major debate about this provision, the standard of care and the study provision that that we're most concerned about. But issues like too big to fail and detailed questions and concerns about derivatives and so on, those are the issues that are holding up the bill advancing at this point. But if the Democrats get that one additional vote, we could move forward as soon as tomorrow.
Okay. And one final follow-up on the question on the study. Would the SEC itself actually conduct the study, and what do we know about the scope?
Well, the SEC is asked to conduct the study. Now, in the past, the SEC has hired outside firms to assist them in conducting the study, and there's nothing in the bill that would prohibit them from doing that. So. And FSI has participated in the past in similar studies, and we've done so through telephone interviews with FSI staff, FSI broker-dealer member executives, and financial advisor members, and also submitting written materials to the persons conducting the study and through in-person meetings. So we'd expect a similar process to occur again. The study is very broad. It's going to look at all the issues around harmonization. So what standard of care should apply? What resources should be dedicated to the supervision of broker-dealers and advisors? How should those resources be allocated? All of the key questions that have been so much a part of the debate over the last year will be part of the study.
Dave, as far as that Senate bill that is under consideration right now, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about whether that includes the new higher threshold for firms to be regulated by the states. This is a multi-part question, I apologize, and what that may mean to advisors, and I think maybe in general more, what is it that state securities regulators are most interested in as far as regulatory reform?
Well, both the House and the Senate bill would increase the asset threshold for investment advisors so that firms currently that have $25 million or less under management are regulated by their home state. I should say investment advisor firms are regulated by their home state. Both bills would move that threshold to $100 million so that advisors with $100 million or less under management would be subject to state oversight of their activities. And that's a significant change and one that has caused us concern. The reason for that is there's a real lack of uniformity of resources that are available to state securities divisions. So, for example, the state of Florida has a very well-funded and active securities division. But there are other states that do not and that may have a securities division of three or four people trying to supervise a large pool of investment advisors that would grow significantly larger by virtue of this change. And so we're worried that there will be additional regulatory gaps that are created by this move. Now, this is one issue that is not contemplated as being part of the study that the Senate bill includes. And we've raised concerns about it, but I have to say that at this point, it does appear that the final bill will likely include a provision that moves a large number, according to Investment News, about 4,200 investment advisors from SEC registration to state registration oversight and so on.
So, Dave, in general, how would you summarize what state securities regulators are looking for? It's my understanding that NASA, the State Securities North American Securities Administrators Association, is pushing for the fiduciary standard. But if you could just kind of give us a quick overview, what is their primary goal for that they would like to see included in reform?
Well, I think what their primary goal is to get back some of the things they lost over the last decade or so, as their jurisdiction has been pared back by federal legislation. And so they're seeking to gain greater relevance and involvement in the process. They point to the troubles at both FINRA and at the SEC in supervising Bernie Madoff and others, and say that that the states can do a better job and should be given the opportunity to prove that through supervising a larger number of investment advisors. The concerns we have are that the states haven't engaged in that self-critical and public analysis of their compliance efforts, their supervision efforts. In other words, we don't really know what the Texas Securities Division, for example, knew and when they knew it about Stanford and his Ponzi scheme that was operated in the state of Texas. So we're uncertain as to whether they received tips and ignored them, or simply were unaware of the activities occurring there. So it's hard to know exactly what the what role and the state regulators are capable of playing, and whether or not they can do the job that they're seeking authorization to handle.
Might be a subject for a future call, too. Find out more about that. Dave, let me ask you to...
Hey, Shelley and Dave, this is Dale. I'm sorry I'm late, but I've joined the call.
Oh, this is perfect timing. Thank you for getting on with us, Dale.
Sure.
I'm going to ask Dave to give us an update on the 12B1 fee issue, and then got a number of things we want to talk to you about. So 12B1 fees are still on the advocacy agenda, hot topic with advisors. And Dave, just wondered if you could go ahead and give us an update on where that stands.
Sure. Well, the FCC is still considering the issue, and we've seen public statements from Chairman Shapiro of the FCC holding open the possibility that the FCC's review could include everything from reform to repeal of Rule 12b-1. But in meetings with her staff, we've learned that their plans appear to be more modest than that. Indications are that, and certainly none of this has been reduced to writing, there's no proposal out now, and so this could very easily change, but it looks like that the proposal that's expected sometime this year would include certain improvements to disclosure, and we could certainly support reasonable improvements to disclosure. For example, changing the name of 12B1 fees to something that's more descriptive and transparent to investors. Next, that there would be essentially no impact on A-share trails or 12B1 fees, but that C-shares would be impacted, that they would over time convert to an A-share when they hit the overall cap on commissions under the FINRA rules of 8.5%. So there would be a significant impact on C-shares, but again, from the financial advisors I talk to that sell C-shares, it's rare that they have a client hold those funds for 8 years without moving the funds. C-shares, of course, are meant to be traded more frequently than perhaps an A-share. And then lastly, that a new share class would be created that would allow negotiation of the commission that would be paid by the client. And that provision, we've got a number of concerns about how it works operationally and so on. And it seems to be based upon the assumption that there isn't significant competition in the mutual fund market, which we think isn't true. We look at 8,000 or more mutual funds out there, and I believe that there's plenty of competition there. But that's what we understand is the thinking at the SEC at this point. And as I said before, it's until they put it in writing, put it out for us all to see, it could certainly change. But we've been working hard on this issue over the past few years and continue to do so. In fact, later this week, I think Dale is meeting with Chairman Shapiro to discuss 12B1 fee issue and our concerns.
Well, good segue into welcoming Dale onto the call. Perfect timing, Dale, because we're ready to lob some things at you. We told the members on the line that you had just come out of an important meeting with the Treasury Department, so I'm going to ask you just to go right into that. It's my understanding you were meeting with them on the independent contractor issue.
Yeah, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, stick to it.
Had a meeting with the Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, Michael Mundaka, and his staff. He was just within the last two or three weeks received a recess appointment from President Obama into this role, one of the senior political appointees at Treasury. And with me in this meeting was Jim McIntyre. Jim is one of our outside, one of the outside counsels that we use on the independent contractor issue. He's worked, I've known Jim for 20, 25 years, and in a prior life, Jim was the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Carter administration, and then practiced law here in Washington, and is pretty much an expert on the application of these worker classification rules to our business model. So it was a healthy, constructive conversation. We didn't walk out with them promising to fix our problems. That never happens in the first meeting, but I believe we succeeded in making them aware of our business model and how we operate within the rules and why we're concerned about potential unintended consequences on this issue.
And Dale, as some of the things that Dave was talking about, I asked him the question about expectation on timeline. Can you give us an update on that?
Here's what the best intelligence I think we've got right now, and it was confirmed somewhat in this meeting at Treasury today. The most likely path forward in the legislative process on this issue of changing the worker classification rules is through some kind of tax bill, because in Washingtonese, it is viewed as a pay-for. It is viewed as a source of new revenue. If they're able to fix these perceived loopholes in the law that allow companies to abuse worker classification rules, the theory is that that would result in more tax revenue, and the theory is they'll use that tax revenue to offset or pay for some other tax break that they want to continue in the tax code. And right now we're hearing that that is the most likely scenario, probably after sometime after the Memorial Day congressional recess. The thing to remember there is that the congressional calendar gets shorter and shorter and shorter as we move towards the summer and as we move towards elections in the fall. So there are no guarantees that it's going to move, and certainly no guarantees that we're going to be able to solve our problem. It is one of our top priorities, and in fact, we'll be engaged on it quite heavily over the next several weeks.
Dale, I thought it would be interesting and valuable for you to give some perspective to FSI members on the whole people and process involved in FSI advocacy efforts, because you do have a unique perspective being in Washington full-time. So if you could just kind of give us some highlights on what that's like.
Well, I was reflecting on that. It's interesting. I can talk all day about all these nuances in the congressional and, you know, the legislative strategy and et cetera, and I'd be the only one on the line at all interested in any of that. I think what matters most to our members is what headway are we making on getting more certainty in the regulatory environment, more certainty on these big issues and potential threats to their business. That's what I really stay focused on. In my view, the key to gaining that outcome is FSI getting influence. So, and the key to gaining influence is building credibility. It is very similar to how our members build and maintain their businesses. They cultivate relationships with existing clients. In our case, we are building and cultivating relationships with people in key policymaking roles, whether it's an assistant Treasury Secretary or a member of Congress, a chair of a prominent committee, or a brand new congressional staff member who's been assigned to work on an issue that's important to us. We're constantly seeking to cultivate those relationships, and it's very, very important that we do that. We build those relationships on a foundation of integrity, and by that I mean up here, we have to show up well informed, have our facts right, make sure that we're telling them, giving them the complete picture, and doing that consistently over time, I think, is where we get to get that influence we're seeking.
And maybe you could just give us a look at the meetings that you've got coming up, sort of a little peek at your Washington calendar, what meetings you have scheduled and what some of the issues are, if there's anything different than we've been discussing today.
Sure. And you know, one of the interesting things about your question about people and process is that I mentioned, you know, policymakers, et cetera, but a part of the path towards influence that we're seeking is also working with like-minded organizations. So we're constantly in and out of coalitions, if you will, both formal and informal coalitions on various issues. So, for example, one of the I mentioned just a moment ago, we're going to be involved for the next several weeks in what I would term sort of a full court press on the independent contractor issue in front of the getting in front of members of the House and Senate tax writing committees and their staff. Well, we're doing that. We're coordinating that with folks from FPA and CIFMA and ACLI and other industry organizations that have a similar view on the issue. Much closer on the calendar, tonight, the FSI board is having a dinner. Our special guest at dinner here in Washington will be FINRA CEO Rick Ketchum. Great opportunity in a less formal setting to talk about some of the important issues between FSI and FINRA. Our board meets tomorrow here working on some strategic planning, and then we'll take our board members to Capitol Hill tomorrow, where they'll be putting some shoe leather to it, so to speak, meeting with their own elected officials, but talking about the independent contractor issue and regulatory reform. Dave mentioned FSI Chairman Mari Buechner and I have a meeting on Thursday morning with SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro to talk about the 12B1 fee issue. And so that's just a flavor of some of the things that that I've got going on the next several weeks.
Dale, you mentioned FINRA, and I want to go back to Dave with this quick question, and then we want to get to some of the members' questions. FINRA just completed their district elections, Dave, and I just wondered if you could give us a quick update on how FSI was involved in that and what the results were.
Sure. Well, since FSI's founding, a key part of our advocacy strategy has been to have a presence on the FINRA district and other committees so that we have the ability to interact with the regulator on an ongoing basis and exert influence on the regulatory proposals they're developing to build our credibility, as Dale talked about, and ensure that we're a player within the organization as changes that impact our members' business are being considered. And we're pleased that as a result of the new FINRA District Committee elections, we've got 26 members serving on the various districts. In addition, we've got 14 members on the nominating committees, and that's an important role. Nominating committees choose who will fill the vacant slots as the year moves on. And with a greater presence of independent firms on the nominating committees, we have more of an opportunity to continue to have our members serve. FINRA also has a number of standing committees, and we have 20 of our members that serve on those standing committees. And those committees represent different segments of the industry and offer their perspective on important issues that could impact the business of those sectors.
I wanted to take the opportunity to mention to the members on the call that that information about FINRA district elections was in one of Dale's posts on Twitter. So I want to mention to you that FSI is involved in some social media and would love to connect with you that way and where you can get some updates on what's going on. Rather than me trying to tell you to, you know, their names on Twitter and to follow them, you can find at the bottom of any FSI email the connection buttons to connect with FSI on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And you'll get some regular updates on advocacy efforts and in particular meetings that Dale is having in Washington and important things like these FINRA district elections. If you have any questions about that, please do let us know. You can send us an email and ask more about the social media information. I want to get to a couple of questions that were emailed in from some members, and in case we have not gotten them answered for you, let me just go into a couple. There was a number of questions about 12b-1 fees, and I think Dave gave you an update on that, but that is continually addressed in the advocacy communications that come out from FSI. There was an important question from a member that said, would you please clarify FSI's position on opposition to fiduciary standard? So I don't know, Dale or Dave, which one of you wants to take that one, but I think that's a question that this member would like answered.
Well, I think that I'll take just one quick crack at it. It's a fair question, an important opportunity to clarify. We're not opposed to a higher standard. What we've tried to articulate is a couple of things. Everyone providing advice to consumers ought to be held to a universal standard of care, a new universal standard of care, based on certain principles. We have tried to articulate that there are problems with simply applying what everybody believes they understand the current fiduciary standard to be on broker-dealer, the broker-dealer activity. And so that's why we believe it's better for us to develop a new federal universal standard of care. Making it shorthand, we're opposed to the fiduciary standard is not exactly accurate. And the other important part of that, though, is a higher standard is in fact not really a higher standard if it's not coupled with more robust supervision and examination of investment advisory activity. One of the biggest problems we face, our members face, is the regulatory gap between how vigorously their broker-dealer activity is supervised by their broker-dealer compliance department, by FINRA, the SEC, et cetera, and relatively speaking, how few resources are available and how little time is available by the SEC and the states to supervise investment advisory activity. And so we're working to see that regulatory gap closed.
And Dale, one final question for you. And let me mention to everybody on the line that if we didn't get to a specific question, Dale or Dave will follow up with you by email. But this one was mentioned by a couple of people, and we touched on it, but Dale would like to ask you just to expand on it a little bit, on the issue of C-shares being a target.
Well, Dave mentioned that. It's one of the things we heard 2 years ago when we met with the SEC on their thinking about changes to 12b-1s. And we hope to leave our meeting with Chairman Shapiro Thursday with even greater clarity. What we've heard is that they're thinking of splitting out the what we now know as a 25 basis point service fee and maintaining that and subjecting the ongoing asset-based sales charge, what I think everybody now knows as a C-share, subject that to FINRA's rules on commissions, which would mean ultimately subjecting it to a cap. I want to emphasize, underscore what Dave said earlier in describing that. We've not seen any of this written down in terms of a formal proposal. And it's all been, at this point, meetings, conversation. So we'll know for sure when the SEC publishes a formal proposal. All of these meetings and conversations we've had to this point are laying the groundwork for us to understand more of the background and where they're coming from and position FSI as an integral part of the dialogue in shaping the final outcome.
Well, and that's a good opportunity for me to emphasize that the members should always be, you know, reading the electronic communications. Inside FSI comes out the first of the month. The advocacy update is the middle of the month. This month just came out today. And so we always try to keep you informed on what's going on and any latest developments on these issues. I want to conclude because we've tried not to have these run more than 30 minutes, to not take too much time out of your day. I want to thank all of you that are on the call, taking the time to be on the call today, and we hope you'll be back with us on the next call, which will be on July 20th at 4 p.m. And a final reminder of that next issue survey that will come out in a week or two. And we will continue to keep you updated on everything that's going on through regular member communications. So thanks again for being with us, and have a great week.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.